Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 51 featuring Dr. Doug Roble. Gina, do you know who Dr. Doug Roble is?
I do. He is the software contraptioneer.
I think it's what was the title, Stephen? He signs his emails as computer graphics contraptioneer.
Contraptioneer, yes.
I don't know what his real title. I think his real title is creative director of software or something like that. Mm-hmm. He is an incredibly, but I think the signature one is probably mm-hmm. the best description of him.
Yeah. At Digital Domain.
Yeah, he is. He's definitely Digital Domain. Mm-hmm. He is one of the original hires at Digital Domain. He's somewhere in the 30s in terms of original employees from 1993, and probably the most senior person at Digital Domain right now in terms of being there the longest by far. Really, really bright guy. He has won at least one SciTech award, maybe more, which is, the Academy gives out scientific and technical awards for research done. And he's actually on the committee of the SciTech award as well. So he is really, really bright. I wanted to ask him some questions about the future of visual effects and VR. Not VR, actually. We talk about VR. We'll talk about that in a second. And he had some really interesting insight as to what has happened, what is innovation, what are some of the things, the groundbreaking stuff that's happened. We talk about fluid sim, we talk about image, computer imaging, and we talk about rendering as well. And we had a really great discussion on the subject of important sampling. So for all you technical geeks out there, this is a great one for you guys. I love Doug, and he's an amazing person. So also wanted to talk about something else, Gina. What did we release this week?
The Guide to VR.
The Guide to VR, that is part of Labs.
Which can be downloaded on labs.chaosgroup.com.
That's right. So go to our site, check out The Guide to VR. We've been working on this for a while. We've been studying a lot of it. We've been talking to all of our good friends. We talked to Justin Denton and Kim Bauman-Larsen and talked to... just figure out all their insight into VR and collaborate this into a document that allows people to figure out what they can do to contribute their own pre-rendered content. Mm-hmm. We did two sample projects, one with Bertrand Benoit and one with Aldo Garcia, of some landmark architectural pieces that are really, really great. And so download those, check those out. Those are 18K cube maps, so really high res. They look great on the Gear VR. And on cardboard, too, we'll be able to show there's some really interesting stuff happening in cardboard, which will allow you to see that happen. Anything else we want to talk about, Gina? Wish everyone a happy holidays.
Exactly. That's exactly where I was going.
All right. Good. Happy holidays, guys. Hope you enjoy the podcast.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
Now, I'm going to start this off by telling you a story about one of my first SIGGRAPH things that I went to. And I believe it was probably, so it was not my first, but it was 1997, I think.
Okay.
And I went to a talk, and I was still in architecture, probably just graduated architecture school. And I went to a talk, and it was about development. And they had the several people from different groups talking, and it was, now I remember who it was. It was you and Johnny Gibson talking about Shrek. Grinch.
Grinch, yes, right, yeah.
And the subject that you guys talked about was long-term development and short-term development.
Really?
And the difference between those two. Do you remember this talk at all?
I am vaguely, yeah, it was a panel.
It was a panel.
Yeah.
And you were talking about the difference between planning software development for long-term software and how he does a TD. He's like, I just got to make a tool in the next week to work for the show. And the difference between those two types of mentality of development.
I'm just thinking about my hubris at that time because I'd only been in the business for about 4 years. And I was telling people my opinions on things like this.
But it was a really
very
good,
bold on my part.
Was it 97? Wait, it was around.
It sounds
that
about
time.
Right.
It
yeah,
sounds
yeah.
about right.
Yeah.
But it was a really good talk.
Well, let's see. 97 was Titanic.
Oh, okay. So it was after that. So it probably was closer to 2000.
Was Titanic. Yeah, that's right. And so it was close. Yeah, Grinch was 99 or 2000.
It was probably around 2000. But I remember specifically that was the first time I'd seen you. So you've been in the industry 7 years.
Yeah. Wow. You were Gibson and I on the same panel.
Yeah.
But
it was a really interesting talk. And one of the things that you were talking about, you came from the perspective of long-term development as opposed to I need a shader to do this or whatever, you know, because
absolutely.
The idea is that a TD makes tools for the, I need something right now to work. And sometimes they make tools that have to work in a half an hour, right?
Yep.
As opposed to planning the long-term software, right? And you were specifically talking about optical flow.
Wow. Yes, you're right. Yeah. Because we use that a lot on, especially at that time, it was really brand new technology.
Yes.
And we're using it to do all sorts of stuff.
Right.
And now it's like, oh yeah, we'll just use optical flow. But at that point we were using it to do a lot of motion blur and all, you know, in motion blur in renderers was really expensive.
Right.
And optical flow was sort of the savior. If you could get optical flow to do a decent amount of motion blur, then boom, you didn't have to do it in the renderer. You could do it in Nuke or you could do it in whatever compositor you're working on. Yeah.
Right. And so I remember that talk specifically about that. And you had mentioned that you had gone to the artists seeing how they're using this new optical flow tool, which was not intended to use on CG elements. It was intended to use on non-CG elements, on live action elements.
Right. And you're saying, yelling at them.
Yelling, why are you using it on? Exactly. You said that specifically. And I remember that very much in my mind. Fast forward about 5 years after that, I'm working at Digital Domain and I'm working on iRobot. And we're working on one of the trailer shots with all the robots climbing the glass. And at that point, we were using RenderMan, and we were ray tracing these robot reflections on the glass.
Right.
And it's the same problem. Motion blur was very expensive to ray trace in RenderMan at that time. And I said, I think I'm going to do the thing that Doug told me not to do 5 years ago. So I remember specifically going to you, and that was the first time I interacted with you. As I said, I remember, it's like, I remember his talk, and I didn't even know I was going to work at Digital Domain or whatever, and I went to you, and you taught me how to use all the optical flow system to make it work for iRobot at that time.
Absolutely, and you know, by that time, I'd come to terms with optical flow and rendered stuff, because initially I thought, wait, the renderer knows how things are moving, right? You just need to write an output driver for
the vector, the
2D motion vector, or even 3D, and you just project it to the camera.
Right.
But
you can't do that if it's reflected.
It's really hard to do it in all cases.
Right.
And for volume elements, just doesn't make any sense at all. And so people were using motion blur to do motion blur on clouds and stuff.
Right.
And that, when I first saw it, I said, the renderer knows all this stuff. But no, the artist was right, actually.
Right, yeah.
And they're perfectly valid reasons.
Interesting.
Yeah. And even now, motion blur is still slow.
But yeah, it is. I mean, you're sampling more stuff, right?
Right.
So you have to figure that out
as
you're going. So I remember that very specifically. It was like one of the first things I was learning. And I was always fascinated by your background. Now, one thing I noticed, and this is something that I say all the time, you are very good at explaining very complicated things in a simple way.
Okay, thank you very much.
And yes, and that's a very highly sought after skill, which I think, especially in a context like SIGGRAPH, is critical. And I don't know why people don't do that more often, to be honest. Because I think some people like to say things more complicated than it is because they think it's like, oh, this is really complicated. And so they try to make it sound more complicated.
Oh,
but the art of simplifying something is really, it's actually more skillful. So Does it just take practice, or how have you sort of honed that in over these years? And I'm going to go back to your past a little bit, but I wonder, like, over the years, how did you find a way to explain things in a simple way?
Well, it if we really start at the very beginning, when I was working on my PhD, I had a TA position at the Ohio State University.
Mm-hmm.
And so instead of, you know, when you get a PhD, you can either have support from a grant that's sponsoring research, or the school can often sponsor you, and instead you pay for your PhD by teaching your way through college.
Right.
And so I had a TA, which gave me a little bit more freedom in terms of what I was doing in terms of research, but it also meant that I was teaching a lot. And
right.
The first class that I had to teach, and sort of the main class that I was teaching, was Pascal for business students.
Really?
Yes. And this was an eye-opener for me, because first of all, I'm trying to teach Pascal. And remember, this is back when we just barely got out of the caveman era. This was the 1980s, because I'm horribly, horribly old.
Mm-hmm.
And computer programming at the time, everybody knew that computer programming was important. But nobody wanted to actually do computer programming, because this was the 1980s. It was, computers were cool, but no, you know, the school realized that this was going to be a thing, but students didn't, and especially business students didn't like it. They didn't want to learn Pascal. They were like, what? Why do I want to get this? So I had to learn this skill of teaching people, and lots of people. These were classes, there were a lot of business students at the time, and so I was teaching 100 to 200 people in a class, how to program in Pascal to students who weren't particularly interested in learning how to program in Pascal.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, especially in our industry, programming is such a, like, a natural. But back in the 80s, programming was really different. It was a whole different way of thinking, and actually explaining that to people who didn't have access to programs in general.
There was no language for it, right?
Yeah, I mean, this was...
I mean, like a thought language, or
anyway. Right. Video games weren't a real thing back then.
Right.
I mean, it was just all sort of starting out. The, you know, you had the Super Nintendo and things, but you didn't have smartphones. You didn't have the web by any means, mm-hmm. where just there's this sort of thing that you learn about telling the computer a command and then it responding in an appropriate way. And that concept was really foreign to everybody. And so explaining like a loop or an if statement,
mm-hmm.
and the fact that it's actually controlling what the computer is going to do next, it's really hard. And it's really hard for the students to get a hold of that. And so I realized you really have to do that simple thing. You have to make sure that there are certain people in the class who are just going to get it. But then there's a large swath of people in the class that are really struggling to get the basic concepts.
Right.
And that works all the way through, whether you're a business student taking a Pascal course, or you're sitting in a SIGGRAPH talk,
mm-hmm.
or a SIGGRAPH technical paper. There's a small percentage of the audience there who has complete knowledge of the field. They just know everything about that field, and they can look at the paper and just sort of get it.
Mm-hmm.
But then 95% of that are just interested in it. They just like, ooh, I saw a picture and that was cool.
Yeah.
And if you go to SIGGRAPH talks,
yeah,
things are getting so complicated that it's they just dive right in and leave the 95% behind.
Yeah, yeah.
And the 5% are like, okay, I get it. They're not bored, but you know, they're the ones who you're being talked to.
Right.
And that seems such a shame to me. It's like,
yep,
here's something cool. You have an opportunity to explain it to a huge audience,
mm-hmm.
and if you just dive right into it, it's a shame.
Yeah.
So that's what I always try to do. Whenever I explain something, and it does require a lot of practice. It's really hard to do. But you always have to imagine that there are people who really understand it, and then there are people who are just interested in it.
Mm-hmm.
And it requires a lot of discipline. And you have to, like, as you know, I do a weekly technical talk.
Yeah, I was going to talk about that.
The Chalk Talk.
Mm-hmm.
And I take a research paper, something cool that I'm just personally interested in, and I present it. This This is a tried and true thing from academia. Mm-hmm. If you go into grad school, professors will run what are called seminar courses, mm-hmm. where the student, you know, a student gets assigned a paper, and every week one of the students comes in and presents the paper. And so every student in the class has a paper, and eventually they come to them and they say, okay, you're going to present the technology and explain this technology to the rest of the class.
Right.
I love those courses. Those were so cool because the act of actually explaining something to the rest of the class who aren't reading your paper, they're reading their own paper, that's...
Yeah, because they're not they haven't even become an expert in that subject yet, right?
Exactly.
Yes.
And you are supposed to, but you're also supposed to explain it to these guys who aren't. You know, they're grad students, so they're capable of handling complicated stuff, but you have to really explain it to them. So I love doing that, and I wanted to continue doing that at when I was at work. And so every week we do this, and I'll take a paper and we take requests, whatever paper is interesting. Yep. And I try to explain that to the company, where the company consists of software people,
artists,
TDs, mm-hmm. People who are just interested in the technology.
Insurance, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And so it's very easy for me to start writing a complicated equation on the board and then just move on. But I always say, whoa, 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 whoa. There are artists here who are freaking out because I wrote integral sign on there. We have to explain that this integral is summing up over this area, and you really want to stop and sort of say, well, wait a sec, what is this math doing?
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, that's important to me too.
Yeah.
Because it's very easy to look at an equation and go, okay, that does something. But then once you understand it enough to explain it to anybody, then it becomes like, oh, right, I get the whole process. I see what they're trying to solve here.
Yeah. And I was a math major in undergraduate. Okay. Yeah. And so I was very, very blessed at Colgate to have some really great math teachers.
Those are the best, right?
Yeah. And they would explain things so well, and that's probably why people enjoyed the math department there. Now, it was a really tough department, but they reveled in trying to say things until you got it, you know, because it's complicated stuff, and it's really great to do that. But of course, like you said, they're experts in the field. I remember specifically one of my advisors who was applying for his tenure at the time, and he was giving his presentation, and he introduced this thing because he was doing something on ring theory and mathematics, which is crazy complicated.
Crazy. Yeah. Super crazy. Yeah.
And so he was doing something on that. And so he said, well, my uncle always told me that if you can't explain what you do to a 7-year-old, you're probably a con artist.
Yeah, but math people have it really hard, right?
Yeah.
Because there's a difference between SIGGRAPH papers and math papers. And I love going into math papers and trying to understand them. But math papers especially are really hard because they don't tolerate anything. They just dive right in, and if you aren't right there on top of everything, you're lost from second sentence even.
And they try to simplify it so much that you're like two letters means like
everything.
Five pages of information. Yeah.
And if you haven't read all the papers in the bibliography,
right.
Yeah, game over.
Right.
You might as well just go home because you just don't have enough expertise in order to even understand this. And stuff like ring theory. Oh,
It took me. Just to get through abstract algebra was pretty tough, but I loved it. But at the same time, because it really opened my mind.
Right.
But it's like, okay, and that's just the beginning. After that, there's a whole other world behind there. So.
But see, that sort of is a self. Perpetuating kind of thing, mm-hmm. because you go to math conferences, and of course they're talking to just pure experts. They are not talking to the artists in the room.
No.
They are talking to, all right, I've got 15 minutes to explain my little tweak on this math, and I have to do it exactly because I know 7 people out there understand it.
Yep.
Wham, they are into it.
Yeah.
It's tough.
I remember specifically on my abstract algebra classes, my teacher would allow us, he did the tests in the evening
okay.
because they were untimed and open book. that's how hard they were.
Of course, yes. The open book tests were always the hardest.
You can reference anything you want to. You have as much time as you want to. And the questions are like two lines, and you have like five lines to answer the question. And
yeah,
really hard, really hard.
Open book tests, they always scared the crap out of me.
But okay, so let's go back to Chalk Talk, and specifically what you're talking about, the talks where you talk about a subject that you're not familiar with.
Right.
Okay?
Oh, yeah.
And so I remember very specifically you gave a very, very important talk, specifically related to some of the company I'm working for, on important sampling on Monte Carlo.
Oh, yeah.
Do you remember that talk?
Yeah, absolutely.
So first of all, let's go through a little history. And as much as you can say, first of all, why did you give that talk? Why was it important at that time?
Well, I've given a couple of talks on this. One of them is the Metropolis Light Transport equation, that one specifically. That one is my Achilles heel. That one algorithm has always baffled me.
Okay.
It's the super hardest thing that I've just never been able to wrap my head completely around it.
Okay.
I'm pretty good at wrapping my head around things. And that one just really.
That's really funny that you say that, because I can't imagine that myself. But
yeah, it's that one is just, for some reason, there's some part of it that just is half a step ahead of me that I've never been able to grasp.
Uh-huh.
And so what I'm doing there is I've done a lot of important sampling or kind of talks on rendering and light transport and this kind of stuff, just to sort of fill in the gaps of that for my own benefit.
Okay.
And as, along the way, it's really important to what we do. So these are awesome topics to talk about. And Metropolis light transport isn't important sampling. It's more just how you transport light through a scene.
Mm-hmm.
But important sampling is just one thing that's so important to rendering that you got to do it.
Right.
Yeah.
But there was something specifically that was happening at for the SciTech Awards just before that.
Oh, well, there's that.
Yeah. Well, how much can you talk to me about that specifically? Or first of all, what was your role at for the SciTech Awards at that point?
Okay, so I can definitely talk about that. So, and in fact, I like talking about that. I've been involved with the Academy's Scientific and Technical Academy Awards for, I guess, 16 years now.
Yeah.
I got a SciTech Award in 1997 for some computer vision stuff. And then 2 years later, they asked me to join the committee that helps make the decisions on this.
Right.
Because they were looking at some technology that was related to computer vision again.
Okay.
And they said, okay, could you come on there? And then I had a great time. It was interesting. It was fascinating. And they asked me back on the committee, and I've been there pretty much ever since.
Mm-hmm.
And for the last 8 or 9 years, I've been co-chair of the Digital Imaging Technology Subcommittee.
So there's a subcommittee in the SciTech.
Yeah.
Right? So there's like people involved with like cinematography equipment and different types of things, and so you're specifically for that branch.
Yeah. The Scientific and Technical Academy Awards are set up so that there is a main committee. The main committee is about 40 to 45 people,
mm-hmm.
and it's basically the sort of the leaders of the technological fields. So, you're absolutely right. There are cinematographers there. There are sound guys. There's lens people. There's all sorts of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then over the years, digital people, computer people came in. So I think the first computer people that had come into the main committee were people who were doing motion control software rating.
Right.
And like people who wrote CAPS. Remember CAPS from Disney, which was this was given a Scientific and Technical Academy Award in 1993. It was the stuff they'd built to do the digital compositing and digital painting for, they transitioned from doing everything on cells to doing it all on computers.
And
that was CAPS. That was their big, huge transition to doing hand-drawn features using the computer.
Okay.
And so that was sort of the beginning of the transition, or at least the invasion of software people into the what had traditionally been a very set-oriented and camera-oriented kind of awards process.
Mm-hmm.
So Digital Imaging Technology Subcommittee was something that they formed in the, I think, 1998 or something like that, mm-hmm. to specifically look, have a group of people who are expert enough to look at software development.
Okay.
Whether it was in visual effects or anywhere. And so that was the committee I joined in 1999 or 2000. And then I became co-chair in something like 2006 or so. Mm-hmm. And I've been co-chair ever since.
Okay.
So the process is that we get submissions and in the summer from people who think they have, you know, award-worthy technology.
Right.
That's one of the main misconceptions with the Scientific and Technical Awards is that we don't choose them.
No,
we let the
they
developers
submit their things.
Submit
right.
it, yeah.
Right.
And so that's the first sort of barrier that you have to get to is that you yourself have to think that the technology that you've developed is worthy enough to be considered. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, you're writing something, you're your own worst critic, right? You know,
right.
This is trivial. Anybody could do this. But then somewhere along the line,
I've been talking to Vlado about this.
Yeah, exactly. This is super easy. Why would anybody want to award this? But somewhere along the line, you go, hey, everybody at my company is using this on an almost daily basis, and nobody else seems to have this. Maybe this is something that was an actual real invention that should be awarded.
Right.
So somewhere along the line, people get to this point and say, hey, does this actually look like an Academy Award? Mm-hmm. So they submit it, and then the process starts. And the first thing that we do is we look at the submission and say, yeah, this could turn into an award. Not this is an award. This is investigation worthy. We want to look at this field. We don't know if it's going to be an award. Maybe it will, maybe it won't, but we know that it's interesting to look at. Mm-hmm. So now finally getting to your original question about important sampling.
Right.
We had some renderers. Every once in a while we'll get renderers submitted or some rendering technology. And that year some rendering technology had gotten submitted and was part of an investigation. And of course, in order to do this investigation, you have to learn about the field. You look at other technology.
It almost sounds like patents.
It totally is, yeah. Right? Because if somebody invented something,
right,
we just don't give it an award. We have to say, all right, well, were you first? Did you actually do the invention? Did you hear about it from another company where somebody else is doing it, and did you implement it first? Or you know, we want to know basically the entire history of that technology. Mm-hmm. And it's getting to the point now where we've pretty much awarded something in almost every field.
Right.
So now, when somebody submits something, it's usually an augmentation or an improvement on something that already existed. So we've had awards for compositors, but we will look at new compositing technology. We just want to make sure that it's enough of an invention over
right.
what had already happened. So
right.
So we have to really dig deep. We have to go and find out what was there at the beginning and what you've done to add to it and if anybody else was doing something. And in fact, one of the things that surprises people a lot is that you may submit something for an Academy Award. Mm-hmm. That will trigger an investigation of the entire field. And then we might not award what you submitted. We'll award something else that we discovered along the way
to
that didn't
else.
Even submit.
Right. Yep, which is kind of almost what happened in this case.
in this case, and it definitely did.
Yeah. So let's go through that history because I want to. A couple things I want to talk about is what happened out of this and what is important. Like a little bit of what important sampling is, because some of my audience may not necessarily understand what that is and what's important about it.
Right. Well. The one thing that I have to be really cautious about is talking about the details of an actual investigation.
Yeah, we don't have to go through that.
Okay, but
there was an investigation, we can say that.
There was an investigation, and it's important. The Scientific and Technical Academy Awards Committee is always struggling with openness.
Right.
Because we don't want to be perceived as this smoke-filled room kind of thing where somehow right. magically, an award pops out.
Right.
It would be much better for us if everybody knew what was going on in the awards process. Mm-hmm. But the problem is we want people also to be able to talk about the details of the development in complete openness.
Right.
And so the exposing our awards process and exposing how it all works really defeats that. It's the then all of a sudden people start trying to game the system. They try to figure out how to work the process. And
right.
it just isn't, it's not the right way to do it. There sure. has to be a certain amount of secrecy.
Right.
And yet we've started talking about the awards like I'm doing right now.
Yeah.
To make sure that people understand that, you know, the people who are doing the awards are really, really serious about it.
Oh, yeah,
and they
yeah, yeah.
don't want to make any mistakes. They hate making mistakes.
Well, first of all, most of these people are come from a scientific background, right?
Right.
So yeah. they try to deal with things as analytically as possible and less emotional as possible. So I remember specifically, the reason I was interested in it, because I, you know, obviously I was interested in important sampling. That's what I do every day in my life as a lighting artist, right?
Right.
I know important sampling. I know how important it is, no pun intended. But what was interesting to me was like saying, your specific chalk talk was very much that. It's like, all right, I don't know much about this, but this is what I figured out. And
yeah.
you presented it to us because it was an important part of your investigation. You had to become a semi-expert in this field, right?
Right. Because we have, the people in the committees have various expertise.
Right.
I know fluid simulation, I know computer vision, and I know of other aspects of this, but
right.
sometimes you're asked to investigate something where you're like, you're not the expert.
Mm-hmm.
Usually we include at least one or two experts on each investigation.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is, if we're investigating a field, the real experts are the guys who are being investigated.
Yeah, exactly.
And so it's...
So it's kind of hard to find a third party expert on this.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah. So what we're looking for are just people who are really good at understanding technology
right.
and understanding the development process. So in the important sampling thing, that's exactly what happens, is we all start filling in the gaps of our knowledge
mm-hmm.
to make sure that, hey, I know that ray tracers, I know how ray tracers work. I know that sending out an array is very expensive. Important sampling is incredibly important for figuring out a good distribution of
samples.
Yeah. And to make sure that you know exactly where the light is, the important, obviously, light is falling and where that kind of stuff happens.
Right.
But if you'd asked me at the beginning of the investigation, hey, well, how does that actually work? I would have gone, I understand the basic concept, but
right.
the actual details of it is actually tricky.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where... reading papers, and then if I'm reading papers, I'm doing chalk docs.
Right.
That seems perfectly reasonable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so you found through this that I think Eric Wieck
right.
was the person that was awarded a SciTech award for important sampling. Now,
yes.
Who is he?
Okay, well.
Because this is really cool to think about that, to think it's like all of these rendering engines are dependent on this person's, not dependent, but that's kind of the spark, right?
Right, absolutely. So the this was all prompted for an investigation into not just important sampling, but physically based rendering, right?
Yes.
This was a couple of years ago. This was like 5 or 6 years ago now, right? I think.
Which one? The important sampling one?
The Eric Wieck.
The Eric Wieck one was awarded, believe it or not, it was awarded in 2014. So it was probably 3 years ago that it was investigated.
2014 was just last year. No.
Maybe it was 13. Maybe it was 13. But it wasn't that long ago because I was looking it up today.
Yeah. Yeah, no. It kind of blurs together the exact dates and stuff.
And then,
it was in the relatively recent time.
And then the physically based rendering was awarded a year after that, I believe.
No.
Or before that.
Before that.
Before that. Okay.
Yeah, we've had multiple rendering awards.
Right.
The last, the year Eric was awarded was, I think, 3 years ago. And yeah, you're right.
Yeah, okay.
So we were looking at physically based rendering. There's been a lot of work in physically based rendering, and a couple of renderers had applied for an investigation, you know, mm-hmm. as possible awards. And yeah, at the end of it all, we had awarded two things. There was the Eric Wieck's thesis,
mm-hmm.
which we had determined was uniformly used throughout as a technique in order to do this, you know, to figure out where light goes.
Right.
And then there was the physically based rendering book.
Right.
Right. And that book was on everyone's bookshelf.
Yes, it was.
And it also came with a whole bunch of sample code.
Yes.
And the Academy, after doing a huge investigation, realized that this is a very involved and evolving area of technology.
Right.
But there was two constants, and they were sort of the pioneers of the field, really. They really set the stage for this. And the Eric's thesis and this book mm-hmm. were the progenitors of a huge amount of technology.
Right.
And all of a sudden we went, wow, this is exactly what we want to award. We want to award something where it really, and especially when we're looking at awards, we look at three basic axes. There's the amount of innovation, mm-hmm. the impact on the industry.
Yep.
So how much is this technology adopted by the industry? Is it used on every set? Is it the go-to technology for, you know, people who want to do whatever you're doing in film? Mm-hmm. And then also the impact on film itself. Does it Right. allow you to do something brand new? Is it give you the ability to create something on the screen that no one's seen before?
Right.
Or do something on the screen that everybody has seen before, but do it for 10 times cheaper?
Right.
So all of a sudden we looked at this and we were like, wow, look at this technology, or the inventions that Eric came up with in his thesis and the process that was laid out in this book are used everywhere. It was just the foundation of rendering in one way or another.
And right.
All the renderers are different in their own ways. No problem there. But at the core, there's this tech that was generated there. And so that's exactly what we want to recognize.
And the side note is that Eric's thesis was not necessarily related to rendering, right?
No, yeah.
It had nothing to do with rendering.
He was a mathematician, right?
Right. Yeah, so.
And he's currently working at Google.
He's working at Google, and I believe his algorithms are being used for AdWords.
AdSense.
So if you get an ad on Google, you're using the same algorithm that you're using to ray trace your scenes,
uh-huh.
which is kind of crazy if you think about it. Because it goes out there and says, this person out of the scattering of samples is probably most interested in this thing.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
Same technology.
Is
that crazy?
It is so crazy.
I love that.
Yeah.
I love that idea. And so I really think that, when did that paper come out? 97, you said, or so?
I think his thesis, and I think it was 1999.
Okay.
I'm pretty darn sure it's 1999.
Okay. Well, that's to me, and I think, you know, specifically for my crowd, and I'm hoping that a lot of the developers at Chaos Group are going to listen to this. They're going to sort of hear that little bit of history about important sampling, because I think it's kind of cool to think about that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And it's amazing technology. The cool thing, by the way, as long as we're talking about Google, it's interesting that some of our technology is permeated into Google, and now Google's technology is coming into our industry.
Really?
Yeah. And when you'd asked me about doing this talk, I was thinking about, what are we going to talk about? I have no idea what we're going to talk about. But the one thing I thought is the fact that data mining and neural networks and machine learning mm-hmm. are things that have powered Google for the last 10 years, right? They're just going harder and harder into all this stuff.
Oh, yeah. It's amazing how quickly it can type out the things that I say to it, because it just knows how to build that sentence.
Well, you want to look to the future of visual effects?
Yeah.
Look to that.
Yeah.
All those technologies are starting to come right back into visual effects. And there's a paper that I just did a talk on by mm-hmm. that was very exciting in SIGGRAPH Asia. I don't even think that's been presented yet, but we were doing a preprint on it where they were using machine learning technology to do fluid simulations.
Oh.
It is the sexiest paper
really?
I've seen in quite some time. It is awesome.
Really?
And, it's from the guys at ETH Zurich.
Uh-huh.
And it's called Regression Forests for Fluid Simulation or something like that. I don't have the paper right in front of me.
Okay.
Brilliant paper. And orders of magnitude faster fluid simulations out of
really?
It.
Really?
it's one of those papers where you go, I didn't know you could do that.
Yeah.
It was a brand new concept. And that kind of thing of using machine learning technology is starting, we're looking at it all the time for doing computer vision stuff where it's a natural.
Yep.
But also for doing things like character animation, where you teach the computer how things move.
Yep.
Facial animation.
Yeah.
People are doing some really good work with machine learning on facial animation where the face only does a certain amount of motion, right? Mm-hmm. And so if you can teach how, given a performance is captured, how that corresponds to a highly detailed face motion, well, then all of a sudden, you don't have to capture all that much.
You can, and most of it gets learned in, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it's extraordinarily fast.
Wow.
Well,
you and I were, we were both at GTC this year.
Yeah.
And so that's,
and it was all over the place.
That's all they were talking about was deep neural networks, right?
Yeah.
And so
running them on the GPUs.
On the GPUs.
Extraordinarily parallel.
Right.
Naturally parallel.
Right. Yeah. So it's really kind of interesting to sort of think about, all right, so it's actually fast forwarding to a few topics, so I'll go back to them. But I want to talk about specifically, if you think that that's the do you think that that really is the future of visual effects, is or computer graphics? Let's just even broaden it out to computer graphics, because that's what I'm involved in. Is, do you think that's the future, is that we're going to start interpreting things using deep neural networks, where we're going to hyper accelerate things at that point?
I think that's, well,
do you think that, could that translate? If they're doing it to fluid sims, why not do it to rendering?
Exactly. And the potential for speed up using these technologies, and the problem is I'm not all that expert in it. I know enough to be a little dangerous, but I need to learn a lot more, because it's relatively new to me. The guys at Google have been doing it for 10 years, and they're fluent in this stuff. Mm-hmm. But in feature visual effects, it's still pretty new.
Yeah,
and it has the potential to, speed up so much.
Well, that's always the thing, right? So, speed is always the issue. It's like the number one thing we deal in computers is like, how much faster can it be? How much faster can it be? Right?
We
want to do things faster, and it sort of opens up the door. What I've always said is like, well, okay, so it gets so fast, but after a while, it doesn't matter. Like, as an example, the naive person in me would say, I can make my rendering happen in, 2 minutes, but I still have to wait for the compositor and to do this and to do that, and the whole process gets slowed down.
Yeah, but who never render in 2 minutes, because the artist is always going to throw more stuff at it. They'll just say, oh, I don't have to optimize my scene. I'll just run, and now it's running in two hours.
Yeah, again. So there's always this, like, render times never go down. It just gets more complex, right?
Exactly.
But the thing is, it's like, if you keep speeding things up, it's sort of learn new things. So using GPU technology as an example, we started ray tracing things really fast. We did this thing with Kevin Margo, where we were actually ray tracing while we were motion capturing. So
seriously, really?
Yeah, I should show you a video. So we actually put like some, we had a person in a motion capture suit, and we put three big GPUs on it and see how we could do it. And it was like, oh, that's pretty good. It was noisy, but we could get it. And then it's like, and then we just put it up on the cloud and transferred it over to the NVIDIA cluster and put 32 GPUs on it.
Hello.
And see how fast it could go. And we could actually get some really clean images at 24 frames a second. It was pretty incredible.
Wow. Okay.
So it's possible. And so I'm like, all right, so wow is what the question is. But then what it does is it goes, what does that mean? Why?
Exactly.
What?
Yeah.
Because now it means like, oh, if I'm ray tracing that fast, then that means that I can be seeing final frame renders while I'm animating.
Right.
Or while I'm doing previs.
Right.
Or while I'm modeling. So rendering is no longer something you save for the end because it takes so long. You're just rendering the whole time.
Right.
So now it's be like, it sort of changes the entire pipeline and the whole mentality. And then for our point of view, from Kevin's point of view, he said, if I'm ray tracing on the motion capture stage, then why don't we bring the DP back in here and actually light it correctly the way a DP would like to light it?
Right.
So it totally changes the way that you can think about all digital, the whole process. So speeding things up is not just, okay, now I can do it faster and it'll be cheaper. It's not about being cheap. It's about new ways of thinking. If you can fluid sim that fast, then you're going to start doing things that you probably didn't think you would want to do because it would take too long, right?
Right.
So I think it's really important to think about like the impact of speed. It means more than just faster and cheaper.
Absolutely. Yeah. But it also means the interesting thing, especially with machine learning, is that it's there's always a trade-off in our field about time or the CPU cost versus the memory cost, right?
Yes.
So if you have an enormous amount of memory, then you can actually front load the memory with a lot of data and make what your CPU has to do, you know, faster.
Right.
If I had petabytes of core memory, then I could do a whole bunch of optimizations where I just throw every possible combination into the memory, and then the CPU wouldn't have to do as much because it could just look it up in the memory.
Right.
But that's not always the case. Where you know, once you cast a ray in a ray tracer, if you could remember that ray, for all other rays, you know,
isn't that a little bit what they did over at Disney for their new renderer?
Exactly. Right. And that's exactly the case with machine learning.
Right.
Is that with machine learning, yeah, when you have fully trained your system, then things go fast. But as an example with this paper, they said, okay, well, in order to get this system trained, we have to run 50 fluid simulations using normal techniques. And then we have to use the results of those 50 fluid simulations to train our system.
Right.
And oh, by the way, that takes 4 days of constant running of a cluster of 10 computers.
Right.
So
they have to learn.
Enormous preload. And then once you're done with that, your system is trained to do simulations that look like what you gave it. But if you give it a simulation that doesn't look like, if you try to simulate something that doesn't look like what you've given it, then it's going to start getting a little wobbly, and it could get really wobbly really quickly. So now it's just like that memory versus CPU kind of thing. Where,
but couldn't you just store all that stuff in the cloud forever so everyone can use it?
That's the trick, right?
Right.
If you're Google and you have an infinite number of computers.
Right.
But with us, maybe not so much.
Yeah. Okay. So let's talk about a little bit, because there was a very interesting, I love podcasts, which is why I ended up doing this one, but it was a really great one, TED Radio Hour. Do you listen to the TED Radio Hour one at all?
Every once in a while. But okay.
They did a really great one called Open Source. And it was open source on a lot of different fields, from the origins of open source, and it talked about Linux as an example of like that's the father of, you know, here's an operating system for free and the impact of what that did, right? And the story they say is like, if you don't think Linux is that important, it's like every Android phone is based on it, every router is based on it, and pretty much 99.8% of all computers that you talk to on your computer are using Linux.
Right? And the internet is Linux.
Linux. So that founded, and the reason that it's important is what was different about it, which was interesting, is on the computer side of things, is that traditional software development has a hierarchy. Like someone has the keys and then unlocks all the other keys. But with open source, you know, like, oh, you're dealing with this part of the code, so you do this part. You know, so there is a hierarchy of development that happens in a traditional commercial software side. But in open source, you kind of like, here you go, right? And what was cool about it was just sort of understanding the foundation of different ways of thinking about open source. One of the things they went to and they talked about in the history of it was, I guess it was 17th century, was the beginning of academic papers.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. And the idea was, they compared this, like before that, if you were an alchemist, before chemists were really chemists.
Right.
You didn't share any information with anyone.
Right. It was all trade secrets.
It's all trade secrets.
The invention of trade
secrets. And so what these guys did, and they were called some kind of philosophers, is they said, if you're going to invent something and you're going to do something, you're going to put it out there and you have to show on a piece of paper everything you do so that anyone else can reproduce it.
Ah, okay.
And so that was the idea. And they said that, that basically that was the beginning of academic thought, and it was people being frustrated with everyone thought they had the little secret,
right?
And no one was sharing anything, so no advances were being made.
So when was this? Because certainly in the math community,
right.
Like there were
math community published for years,
per years, yeah, right? Euler and Newton and even beyond all those guys, there was
definitely
a
the math community.
Flow of
I think it was specifically comparing it to things like alchemy and stuff
okay.
like
was
that.
Okay, was it for
right?
science? Yeah, yeah, more of the engineering based field,
right?
Yeah.
So what I think is cool is. What it sort of brought up to me is like, do we do that still here? Do you think that there's a lot of people, I think it's getting better, but what I liked about SIGGRAPH is that it goes out there and it shows people like, hey, here's some really cool stuff. You know, here's something interesting for, and then people learn on that and develop on that. Do you think there's still this sense of, openness about the ideas that are going on in visual effects? Because I'm seeing it a lot more now. I'm seeing like OpenImage.io and Alembic, and people are just like, we're tired of our own formats and our own ideas.
Oh my God, yes. Yeah.
So do you see a trend in open source going on?
Actually, you know, I was just thinking about this in that the first decade that I was involved in computer graphics from a professional side of things, mm-hmm. everybody wrote their own stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
There was the only libraries that you really relied on were like OpenGL and anything that came with the SGIs.
Right.
And there really weren't a lot of libraries out there that you could use. Occasionally you'd find something that was available, but usually that was made by SGI or mm-hmm. Intel or something. There wasn't a lot of things. Maybe you brought something from school with you, but rather than that, everybody wrote their own matrix libraries. Everybody right. wrote their own image processing routines.
Is that a horrible waste of time, everyone doing that?
Well, yeah, but it certainly was. But that was kind of the way it was because there wasn't a lot of open source. There
right.
wasn't a lot of, I mean, this was just the beginnings of this stuff, right? So now you look fast forward a little bit, and the problems have gotten harder to solve, right? All the easy matrix library. In general, that's relatively easy to write.
Right.
And the stuff that you do with a matrix library is relatively simple to do.
Mm-hmm.
So now, if you look at our software development team, they aren't doing software development. They're doing a lot of software development. They're writing a lot of code. But if you look at the code, it isn't so much the very basic kind of stuff. What they're doing is calling a lot of functions that are already existing.
Yeah.
So nobody's doing matrix multiplies or SVDs or any kind of basic stuff anymore. You mm-hmm. just call it library. Or
right.
you download it from Boost. You bring in Boost and you go, I need this routine to do this, or OpenCV or okay. OpenImage.io. Why would you ever write your own image processing package?
Right.
And so what that has done is it's freed us up. In the 90s, we were writing all this stuff. And then there's been this transition where we're going, why the heck am I going to be writing some of this basic stuff? I'll just download it from the web,
mm-hmm.
or I'll buy it from somebody or something. And then now the problems that we're solving have gotten exponentially harder, and mm-hmm. at least the software has gotten available so that we don't have to write everything from scratch, because it would be really slow. And so it's kind of cool watching that process happen. And things, Google is going back to Google and other companies, Facebook as well. They're opening up a lot of software. They're just sort of giving it away so people can use it. And we're immediately pulling it in and starting
now
to
use
it.
Now, why are they doing that?
Well, Google has these companies. They have to, to be honest, I'm not really sure. There's got to be a business model for it. There's certainly.
Yeah, but I think it's fascinating. And a company that, obviously they're making so much money off advertising, it doesn't really matter to them, I guess, but they want something to grow out of it, right? So they're almost putting it out there so that it gets better or gets bigger, right?
Right. Well, and also if they need software developers, right?
Right.
And this is the same for us. If we want software developers, we expect a certain amount of expertise coming mm-hmm. into here. And so if Google has put out their machine learning code and said, hey, do something with this, then if they've got people coming into that, they've already got a certain layer of expertise with stuff
they've saved themselves 2 years of learning from
exactly.
this.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
And they want the people coming into Google to be ready to go and to be building the next thing, not what they've already invented.
So let's because I have this thing also, because obviously I've worked in visual effects for years, and it's incredible technology. Okay. Just the idea of Fluid Sims, right? Fluid Sims on their own are some of the most incredible technology that in a lot of ways we use it to make a building explode for some action movie. It's a little, to be honest, that's cool. It looks great. I love movies, etc. But it almost seems sad that all of this really hardcore mathematics is just going to explode a building for Van Damme, right? Or some kind of situation like that. I'd love to know, do you feel that the visual effects industry or the technology that happens in visual effects has potential to influence a much bigger place? And where do you think that's going to go?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Well, yeah, totally. And, so fluid simulation is a great way of thinking about it. So the fluid simulation in visual effects really started in the late 90s, where Nick Foster wrote, I think, the first real fluid simulation that was used in movies for ants. Mm-hmm. And then that basically said, whoa, we can do fluid simulation in films. And so that triggered a whole bunch of stuff. And I wrote a fluid simulator, and the guys up at ILM and Weta, and everybody's writing their own fluid simulators.
Yep.
And they're all basing it off technology that had been developed by the engineering communities and people in aeronautics and Army Corps of Engineers, mm-hmm. developing fluid simulation techniques since the 1960s for computers. But the core stuff goes back to Euler again, you know?
Right.
The basic Navier-Stokes equations and the motion of fluid has a huge history of math. Mm-hmm. So, if you go to 2000 and you look at what non-visual effects or non-movie people were doing of fluid simulation, they really didn't care what it looked like. What they wanted were numbers that they knew that could quantify. Mm-hmm. So they were looking for, especially, they were looking for steady state flow. And what that means is, if I've got water flowing through a pipe, mm-hmm. I don't care what it looks like when it's first starting out. I've got a pipe that I'm going to be using to, you know, power a turbine. Mm-hmm. And so what I want to know is what that water in that pipe looks like when it's at speed. And in general, especially if you're not modeling turbulence, what you want to know is not what happens as it's changing, is what when it gets into a flow, what are the pressures involved? So mm-hmm. how big do I need to make the coupling for this pipe? And if I put a bend in it, how thick do I have to make the walls of the pipe? It's very engineering kind of stuff.
Right.
So that's exactly what we don't want in movies. What we are interested in is the dynamics.
The
we
want to
see the change. Right. We want to see the turbulence. We want to see all this. If you're modeling the air over a wing in an airplane, again, turbulence is important for some aspects, but a lot of it is, you know, how do I design the airplane wing to get the maximum thrust, pushing
pressure
upwards,
pressure
upwards? And that's all very steady state again. So when we came into it, we looked at it and went, ah, this isn't what we want. We want dynamic water. We want to track the surface of water. We want to track the motion of gas as it changes. And we want fire and burning and all this action. And so that was what we brought to the table.
Right.
And if you look at the Journal of Computational Physics, you'll see all this stuff. And then all of a sudden, you'll start to see every once in a while a paper coming from Ron Fedke, who says, you know, if you do it this way, you get the dynamic stuff. And ooh, look at this cool stuff. And he was publishing in SIGGRAPH, but he's also publishing in physics as well, mm-hmm. the computational physics community. And they took note. They were looking at some of the stuff that we did for making these pretty pictures, where accuracy wasn't all that much of a big deal. What we wanted is the water to look good.
Mm-hmm.
And then they started taking our technology and saying, well, you know, this stuff, like the level set technology that Ron developed, that percolated back into the engineering community.
Interesting.
And all of a sudden, they're starting to do things like helicopter simulations that they weren't considering before, because it's so dynamic and so turbulent.
Right.
And the visualization of this stuff was giving them abilities to see where their math was failing.
Interesting.
And so it was this feedback loop.
Yeah.
And it still is. It's very much now some of the stuff that we're developing for fluids has
been generated in response to the visual effects community.
Yeah.
It's going right back into the computational physics.
That's great. That's so great. That's a perfect example for what I was talking about.
Yeah. Awesome fun. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And we even, you know, we've brought software developers in from that community, and they were like, this is crazy. We don't want to, this is not what we do. This is math that's kind of off to the side. But now we have people who have left the visual effects community and gone into that field, and they're taking all this new stuff and sort of saying, you know what we can do? We can use our stuff to simulate how tsunamis affect power plants.
Right.
And we had a software developer from Digital Domain who's working now for the Department of Energy.
Did you see the article that came out recently about the engineer who was analyzing all the bridge collapses in movies?
No, I haven't. Right. Oh, no, I saw that. Yes, yeah. I did. That was great.
Yeah.
That went by on Slashdot or something like that.
It was pretty funny.
Awesome. Yeah. Bridges do not collapse correctly.
Yeah, in movies. Yeah, which it makes sense. You know, it's like, why would a suspension bridge just be perfectly still?
All right.
Like
and the worst example was the Dark Knight, the Brooklyn Bridge or the stand-in for the Brooklyn Bridge just sort of stuck there.
Right. It's like they'd be like, boing.
Those cables matter.
Yeah, exactly. So it was interesting because I just gave a talk in, I was at the 3D Symposium, which is an ArcViz community, and I was giving a talk to them. And, you know, all these architecture guys, they all look up to the visual effects. Not they don't necessarily, but a lot of them look up to visual effects, say that's the future of visual of CG, or they're driving the CG movement. And I think that's not actually true, because as an example, architecture drove a huge part of technology that visual
rendering.
Effects. Rendering. Right.
Holy smokes, those guys were doing the coolest stuff.
Global animation was being done in architecture 10 years before it was done in visual effects.
Absolutely.
And people were doing radiosity with Lightscape and stuff like that. And again, that was another thing, right? It was being used to calculate energy conservation, right?
Right. They want accuracy. If the sun comes in this window, how hot's this room going to be?
Yeah.
Right.
So it was being done that way. And it's like, we could actually do this and create an image of it. We could actually see what light looks like when it bounces around the surface. And that's how it created it.
Yep.
So I think there's a lot of... I think it would be great. I mean, I'd love to see more collaboration between industries. I think that would be something. That's one of the things I'm liking about my job right now, is that I'm talking to the architects and I'm talking to the visual effects guys. And I'm like, you know, we can put you two together. We can make something really cool.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
Because you go everywhere, right?
I do go everywhere.
Car manufacturers,
the different kind of medical stuff, you know, all kinds of.
Right.
Yeah, everything. So it's really kind of fascinating to me. And what's happening now is, and I'm trying to change it a little bit in my mind, but I'm seeing it happen in VR right now. In the virtual reality field, as you know, it's been exploding, but it's been a lot. Yeah. But it's a lot of, I got my little thing, you got your little thing. It's like, but you guys are doing this. I spoke to the two of you, and you guys don't even know you're doing the same thing.
Right. Exactly.
And so if you work together, you could get there faster, you know? Yep. So I think there's a lot of that I'd love to see people do and develop a little bit more. We're almost at the end here, but I want to go a little talk. Did you have something to say? Sorry.
No.
I want to ask one last thing. So, how long have you been doing in this industry now? So,
I started at work here at Digital Domain in 1993. So, 23 years.
So you're like one of the first employees of Digital Domain, right? Like
I was the 33rd employee hired.
Uh huh.
And right now, there's nobody's been here.
So you're the most senior person.
I'm the most senior.
Okay. So 1993. That's kind of like the beginning of Digital Domain, obviously.
Right.
And that was your first job.
Well, it was my first job out of school. Right. I had jobs in school, but yes, my first real job.
Wow.
And yeah, the fact that I'm still here is nuts.
Yes.
It's just...
I don't think that's nuts. I think it makes perfect sense.
Like,
I would not imagine if I was not walking in being able to see Doug. In that time, since 1993, what is probably one of the most impactful pieces of technology that you remember that really is like, you know, that was a moment that I remember? Like, let's say this was, you know, what would you say was the most impactful piece of technology that really sort of made you proud or happy or excited or?
Or, well, impactful. Well, as long as we're talking about open source, Linux, right?
Linux?
Yeah, come on. It changed the whole thing, right?
Right.
Because in the 90s, it was all very expensive SGI machines.
Yep.
mean, Linux killed SGI. Basically.
Yeah. Okay.
Linux made it. It changed the entire industry, and all of a sudden, you didn't have to have a huge amount of money to start up a visual effects unit.
Right.
You could. Right. There are lots of other impactful technologies, but because it came to mind because we were talking about open source.
Right.
And you think about it, in the 90s, you had to have a ton of money to start a visual effects company.
Because
these machines were really expensive.
An SGI cost, what, 50 grand, something like that?
Right.
And then you had to have a person that's going to cost you like 80 grand or more, and then you had to have the software was 50 grand a piece. So we're talking like $250,000 per seat.
Exactly. And then all of a sudden, Linux came out, and you could buy a computer at Fry's or whatever, you know, Best Buy.
Yeah.
And you'd put a lot of memory in it, and you'd run Linux on it, and all of a sudden you were doing visual effects that maybe wasn't as good as what ILM was doing, but you were doing visual effects.
Yeah.
And then that started to impact everything. And now you start seeing the credits where these small companies are starting to show up, and all of a sudden, oh gosh, everybody is doing visual effects, and some are better than others, but everybody is doing it, and it changed the industry. It really, that, you know, certainly incentives by governments have changed the industry. But before that, there was that huge sea change where all of a sudden everybody
gave power to everyone to do it.
Yeah.
Right.
And that certainly prompted things like the London explosion.
Sure.
That was all based not on SGIs. That was before that. It was just sort of puttering around. But all of a sudden, those guys could build a huge amounts of computers and farms, and it was huge. That was monstrous. And that all happened in 97, 98. You know, I remember dabbling with Linux for Titanic, and it got so much press because nobody else had been using this. Everybody was SGI, but we had an alpha farm running.
Why
Linux
was it called Linux, by the way? Because it was Unix. It was based on Unix, right?
Well, it was Linus Torvald,
right?
And when he wrote it as a, I'm not an expert on this, but he wrote it as a project, right?
Right.
He wrote an operating system and he called it Linux because you always needed to differentiate yourself from Unix. And it just stuck.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. That's interesting.
Yeah.
I think you're right. I think that, you know, and Linux changed the backbone of the entire computer graphics or computer industry overall, right?
Totally.
Yeah.
So that's one of the things that there's lots of other impactful technology, but it ties in with what we were talking about before.
Yeah. Well, that's cool. So I have one last request, and that is that if I get into a situation where I have some really important piece of technology that's baffling me, and there's something that needs, can I come back here and talk to Doug about it again?
Oh, of course you can.
Okay, good, because it's your insight is always like extraordinarily valuable to me, and I think I just want to be able to introduce people to who you are and be able to come back and talk to you again if I have that opportunity.
Well, and you know, the Chalk Talks are something that I do for employees of Digital Domain, but I also broadcast them. I broadcast them on Google, but I broadcast them to a private group. I don't just, it's not a Google broadcast, but if some of your listeners want to attend, they can send me email at doug@d2.com if they sound reasonable, I'll add them to the list.
Yeah. So doug@d2.com, they can email you and then they can get in on that group. Because I've seen, there's a couple of sample ones that are on the, I think maybe there's one or two sample ones I've seen on YouTube, right?
Yeah, there are a couple, like I said, I don't, because I just ramble about the stuff I'm talking about, I don't know if I should send it out to the entire world.
Gotcha.
Because she's not watching me say whatever I'm saying.
Sure.
But it is if it's a relatively controlled group, then I love having the feedback and I love everything. So.
But I will definitely.
But you're more than welcome to. I love finding out about new stuff.
So I will let people know about that, because I'd love to, you know, if people want to be able to see Chalk Dogs, and also if they happen to be in Los Angeles, sometimes you're inviting people over to Digital.
I love that. Right. Yeah, it's open.
Yeah, because I remember,
just,
like,
you
people
have to send me email.
Right. First, so we'll send you an email so they can come to your Chalk Dogs and stuff like that, because they are really, really great. So anyone who's interested in that, so definitely come by. All right, guys. Thank you so much, Doug. I appreciate it.
Hey, this is fun.
Yeah, it'll be great. And so this, believe it or not, this will probably be up in like a week and a half or less. So,
all right.
So it'll be good.
Was it what you wanted?
Oh, yeah.
Okay,
great.
Yeah, this is fun.
Cool.
I love this.
All right. Thanks, Doug. Appreciate it.
All right. Bye-bye.